Hello, I'm Gemma Birrell. You're listening to a podcast recorded live for Sydney Writers Festival in 2016.
Good morning, everyone. We might get a start, if that's okay. I can see that there are people scalping tickets outside the door, and that's sad for them. But for those of you who have already run the gauntlet, I think we might get going with this morning's session. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne and the host of Blueprint for Living on ABC RN on Saturday mornings. And I'm thrilled to be here with today's guest, Samanth Subramanian. He's the author of This Divided Island. It's an extraordinary book. I'm a massive fan, and this is going to be a lot of fun. Before we go any further, though, I want to take a moment to reflect on our own divided island and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land we're on. This is the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to the Gadigal people, their elders past and present, and the elders of other communities that might be with us today. I like to make the point when I do an acknowledgement of country that for me, an acknowledgement of country is in part an acknowledgement that the moral and legal implications of invasion remain unresolved to this day. We're in an election mode. I don't know if anyone spotted that. It's pretty exciting, pretty edifying. But just 3 short years ago, 2013, before the election was called, before it was fully underway, our then Foreign Minister and our then Immigration Minister, Julie Bishop and Scott Morrison, made a trip to Sri Lanka. They came back from their fact-finding mission with glowing reports of how things were there, and not least for the Tamils, who they said, contrary to so many independent reports, were living peacefully now that the war was over. Bishop said she saw and heard of no evidence of persecution of Tamils during her visit, and Morrison told a press conference that people who talked about persecution were talking in the past. He said things had changed markedly from the days of white van disappearances and torture chambers. Get up to date, he urged critics. Sri Lanka doesn't appear in the news in this country very often, and when it does, it's often deeply politicised. We're looking for a justification to refoul a boatload of refugees, or we're looking for ways to serve our own interests. And so good journalism about it is scarce on the ground. But the best journalist about it is our guest today. He has written an extraordinary work. It was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction in 2015. It wasn't just shortlisted, but it was also robbed. It should have won. It's an amazing book.
That's what they told me backstage.
But yeah, no, that's how it works. Please make him very welcome. I told you beforehand I wasn't going to put you on the spot to talk about Australian politics because I think it's a, you know, it's the third rail of these things. But I want you to take us back to why Sri Lanka for you, because this book isn't a minor endeavour. You spent many years writing it and you gave over your life to it. When did you know this was the next book for you?
Before my first book came out, actually. My first book came out in 2010 in the summer. And in 2009, in May 2009, I was sitting in a newsroom in Delhi, and I was watching on television as the final sort of weeks and then days and then hours of the civil war sort of wound down. And it ended, I mean, on TV at least, it ended with this image, this extremely graphic image of the dead body of Prabhakaran, who was the head of the Tamil Tigers for more than 30 years. This was the Tamil guerrilla group that was trying to fight for an independent state in the northeast of Sri Lanka. And the war essentially ended with his death and with the extinction of the Tamil Tigers. And so I was watching this, and a couple of thoughts struck me. I mean, the first was that, look, I'm a Tamil. I'm a Tamil from the south of India. I speak the same language as the Tamils in Sri Lanka. And as a result of growing up in South India, I had heard and read and absorbed so much about the war. The war sometimes made bigger headlines in my newspapers in Madras, where I'm from, than news from Delhi in the north of India, in the very same country. There were all sorts of, I mean, apart from the linguistic, or because of the linguistic bind, there were social and political connections between the state where I lived and the Tamils in Sri Lanka. The Tigers were in no small part in their early years financed by money from India. The Sri Lankan army and the Tigers were at various parts trained in India. A former prime minister of India was assassinated by a Tamil Tiger suicide bomber a few kilometers outside my city. So,
while you're on a trip with your mother?
While I was on a train heading back home. And, you know, we found this out at 2 o'clock in the morning on sort of a station midway when we stopped to find out exactly what was going on. So, you know, these events were sort of punctuating my life. And the war started a couple of years after I was born. I was born in 1981. The war started in 1983. It lasted as I was growing up, as I finished school, as I went into university, started working, went back to university, started working again. So it ran parallel to my life for most of my life. And so in 2009, when the war ended, my first thought was that of a Tamil from India, but also that of a journalist, which is, look, I mean, this was the first time in three decades that it is safe and possible for a journalist to go around the country and talk to people who haven't been talked to in 30 years, who have not been able to tell their stories about what it was like to live through this conflict for 30 years. Either it wasn't safe for them, or they were in inaccessible parts of the country, or they just didn't want to speak with any sort of freedom. And at the end of the war, suddenly all those, most of those shackles sort of were stripped away. There were still many in place still, but most of the shackles were. And so I felt it almost a duty as a Tamil journalist to go there and do this book, because I felt, you know, if not me, who would do this?
You make the point in the book that it's an uncharacteristically abrupt end to a war. I mean, not only is it a three-decade-long war, but so rarely do we have a definitive moment, a brutal moment,
absolutely,
where we go, and that's the end of the war.
Yeah.
Now we're in peace.
Yeah.
Is that a political illusion? Is that a convenient way to think about it, as the end of something rather than just a change from one state to another?
I mean, it's interesting because in one way it's true. If you think back to, just to take an example, World War II, when did World War II end? Was it with the suicide of Hitler in his bunker? Was it with the victory over Japan? I mean, what is the definitive endpoint for the war? And there isn't one. With this one, in one sense, there was, because the open fighting, open warfare did stop in May 2009 when Prabhakaran died. That's when the army stopped shelling parts of the country where the Tamils and the Tigers were. So it is convenient to think of it in that way. But the state of friction between the two communities that led to the war, that persisted through the war, certainly went on after the end of the fighting. There were still sort of oppressions that the state imposed upon its minorities. There were still civil liberties that were eroded, sometimes in methods that were much greater and more alarming than during wartime. And there were still unresolved political structural issues that didn't go away with the end of the fighting. And that was part of my discovery when I went there, is that a lot of this can continue to flow. There, you know, you could have an end to the fighting, but you can't have an end to the conflict itself. And I think we need to distinguish between those two concepts.
Plus the period that you went, I mean, 2009, that end of the war, came with it significant kind of trauma. The scale of the shelling, conservative estimates, what, 45,000?
Well, the UN says 40,000, but I suspect, and many people suspect, that even that is too low. So what happened was the Tigers, who were the guerrillas, they were forced into retreat to a particular corner of the island in the northeast of Sri Lanka, and they decided to use the civilian Tamil population as a human shield, almost. They embedded themselves within this population, thinking that this would sort of ease the shelling from the army. The army wouldn't shell places where civilians were clustered, that the international community would prevail upon Sri Lanka and its army to stop the shelling while there were still civilians in this zone. But the Tigers, in this particular case, got it wrong. And the shelling continued. There is at least some evidence to show that the army specifically targeted civilian installations like schools and hospitals. And this is the death toll we're talking about, between 40,000 and 80,000 civilians who were killed in the final weeks of the war in this shelling.
This is a writers' festival crowd, so they're very well informed and intelligent people. But here in Australia, when we talk about foreign policy, we like goodies and baddies. It makes it much easier for us to understand what's going on. Can you help us with that? Because it's who are we cheering for here?
It's difficult to tell. You're primarily cheering for the Tamil civilians, I would say, because I think this was a community that at some point in the 50s and 60s and 70s started to get disenfranchised. Not in the classical sense of having their vote taken away, but suddenly a lot of the avenues of opportunity that they had had to employment and education started to be scaled back by this, you know, by governments that acceded to the demands of Sinhalese majority groups. And, you know, there was definitely an effort, especially through the 60s, to find a political solution to this. And the solution and this effort repeatedly failed. And the Tamil Tigers arose in some kind of frustration out of the failure of these political efforts. And what happened through the 80s and then the 90s, the Tamils were, in one sense, almost devoured by this group that claim to represent their interests. Because the first thing the Tigers did through the 80s is eliminate a lot of the other groups that claim to speak for the Tamils. And when I say eliminate, I mean it in the most blunt method. They just killed them. They just killed these leaders. And then through the 90s, they then started to recruit forcibly a lot of the Tamils who did not wish to join the war as fighters. Through the 2000s, as the ceasefire in the early 2000s broke down, and as open fighting started again, the Tigers started to press gang young children, teenagers, and sent them to the front lines with a couple of weeks of training with a gun to be cannon fodder. And these are people who, as a result of all of this, the civilians have been displaced multiple times. I know people who've been displaced a dozen times or more. As the momentum of the war swings from one side to the other. So if there's any, you know, my sympathies certainly lie with this group of people who were not fighters, but who were caught in sort of the crossfire of a lot of this. But politically speaking, it's difficult to distinguish between the state and the Tigers in terms of who should take more blame for the way in which this war played out and the length that it played out in.
You see how acute that analysis was to a very facile question. That's the kind of thing that you can enjoy in this book, and you will enjoy enormously. But the other thing about it is it's a book of extraordinary empathy. It's a kind of work of long-form narrative non-fiction, and it is about giving voice to people who we don't normally hear from. It's these beautiful pen portraits of people who you talk to, their stories. Before we go any further, do you want to do a little reading?
Sure, absolutely. So I should give you some context for the section that I'm going to read. The section is set on the eastern coast of Sri Lanka. I went to a town there called Batticalo, and while I was there sort of, you know, meeting people and traveling around that area, I read in sort of one of these books of Sri Lankan history that I was reading, I read about a couple of massacres that the Tigers had perpetrated in mosques, in two mosques, in a village or a town not far from Batticalo. This was in the early 90s. This was during Friday prayers. And so I decided that I would go there and just sort of see what if these mosques were still standing. So I went there, and entirely by chance in one of these mosques, I met an old man whose nephew, Ismail, was a survivor of one of these two massacres. And so he took me over to see Ismail and introduced me, and Ismail said, listen, I'm off to work now in the morning, but why don't you come back at 5 o'clock in the evening? So this little section that I'm going to read is an account of my conversation with Ismail. And it really, I often read this because I think it's a good example of what the book tries to do, which is just talk to people who lived through a lot of this and who continue to live with it in some ways. And their stories are sort of almost entirely unrecognized or maybe forgotten. So that's the context. I returned at 5 p.m. and we sat in Ismail's living room, where strips of patterned chocolate brown linoleum had been pasted out of alignment on the floor so that it looked as if it was tilting and teetering, like the floor of a crazy house at a funfair. Ismail's blackened feet stuck out of his striped sarong. Printed leaves drifted down the expanse of his white linen shirt as if they were drawn by the gravity of his pot belly. "I've spoken to journalists a couple of times before," Ismail said. "I don't mind telling you what happened that day, but I have a question for you first." "Of course," I said. He wanted to know what kind of book I was writing, I thought. "What good will this conversation do for me?" he asked. I had no answer to give him. I had asked this question of myself often in Sri Lanka, uncapping deep wells of self-doubt. Even in ordinary circumstances, the work of a journalist can feel like that of a parasite, fattening itself on the time and memories of others, but giving back nothing tangible at all. In Sri Lanka, the process felt especially voyeuristic, as I asked people to rehearse the pain of their lives so that I could write a book they would never read. "Will I ever even see you again?" Ismail asked, and the honest answer was, probably not. I wasn't from Sri Lanka, and so after this book was written and forgotten, I would, in all likelihood, visit only sparingly. "It's important that these stories be recorded and told," I could say, as indeed I did say to Ismail. It was true, but at the same time, it must have sounded pathetic and hollow to a man whose relatives had been killed and who still limped because he had 2 inches of shrapnel nestled within his left thigh. Ismail shrugged. "What you can do," he said, "is take down my number, and when the book comes out, send me a copy. Will you do that?" Of course," I said, feeling even dirtier now for having been requested to do so little in exchange for receiving so much. In 1990, Ismail, having finished his A-levels, was working at a shop in Batticaloa, and he had watched ties between the Tigers and the Muslims grow flimsier and flimsier. There was history here. The two groups clashed for the first time in 1985, and when the government created a home guard in 1986 and slyly staffed it with Muslims, relations worsened. The killings began the next year. 30 Muslim passengers on a bus headed to Kathanguri, dozens of Muslim policemen, men and women and children returning from the Hajj. When a Muslim member of the Tigers was mysteriously murdered, 75 people were rounded up in Kathanguri for questioning and were never seen again. Ismail's best friend was one of these 75. I was part of another group of around 50, and we were boxed in on the street by just 3 Tigers with guns. They kept asking us, "Who killed him?" We said we didn't know. When we were dispersed, we didn't know how to leave because we were sure that if we turned our backs on them, we would be shot. We were saved, I think, because one of the Muslims in this group knew some Tigers well. The summer of the mosque massacres had been long and enervating. The army prevented Tamil civilians and traders from leaving or entering the district, so Kathankudi's Muslims, who were permitted to drive to nearby towns, became the sole source of provisions. In June, the Tigers stormed Kathankudi, imposed an ad hoc curfew, and raided the shops to resupply themselves. During this spree of looting, when one Muslim man unknowingly wandered out of his house, he was immediately shot. In July, the Tigers halted and robbed a convoy of goods trucks. Their Muslim occupants, including one of Ismail's cousins, were first herded into a house by the road and then taken outdoors and killed, all 5 dozen of them. August was hot, and you could sense so much tension in the air, Ismail said. We had no food, and we had no electricity, and we had no work. At night, in the streets, neighborhoods burned piles of tires. The tires threw off clouds of reeking smoke, but the light of the flames helped warn families of approaching danger. This was atavism, I thought, man regressing to the survival methods of the wilderness. That day, August 3rd, was really hot, and we were all more tense than usual, Ismail said. Could we go out? Should we? He attended afternoon prayers at 12:30, sat down for an early dinner at 5 p.m., and then decided to visit the beach with 4 friends. Around 6:30, they left the beach to go back home. It was already dark, and the street lamps were dead. Only bonfires of tires threw any light at all on the vacant streets. Ismail parked his bicycle at home, washed his hands and feet, and crossed the road to the mosque in time for the 8 p.m. prayer. With him were his 2 younger brothers, aged 12 and 13, and his 2 cousins. The prayer was about half over when we heard a shot. It was just 1 shot, somewhat far away. I think that was a signal to start. One of the worshippers at the mosque yelled, "Shooting, shooting, run, run." There were 35 people inside the mosque, and only one door functioned as both entrance and exit. By the time the congregants had risen to their feet, the tigers were at the mosque's outer gate. "They told all of us to come out," Ismail said. "There was an old teacher of mine with us. He was disabled with only one arm and one leg. He shouted back, 'There's nobody in here with guns.' 'We'll shoot if you don't come out. We'll fire, we'll fire, we'll fire.'" Ismail emphasized how the warning was repeated in triplicate. He jabbed his finger in the air as if he was ringing a doorbell with impatience. It was difficult to tell how many tigers were outside the mosque, although Ismail could hear them conversing outside and even glimpse them through a window. The mosque was surrounded on three sides, and through the windows in these three walls, the tigers tossed in grenades. Then the barrel of a submachine gun was inserted through a hole in the decorative latticework near the door, and the firing began. Ismail's father had contributed funds for the construction of the old mosque, and so he still had a key for the locked door. He took me in there now, hobbling as he crossed the road. The mosque had a sloping roof, shingles of red clay laid over a frame of round wooden beams. The grenades and bullets had perforated the mosque's walls and pillars, punching untidy circular holes in the masonry. The low, shallow basin where Muslims once washed their feet before prayers was dry. The mosque was hot. The air seemed not to move at all, as if it was still stunned from the events of 2 decades ago. "This is where I lay, see?" Ismail pointed to a spot by the door. "Two other people had fallen on top of me. They were bleeding all over me." After the first squall of firing, there was a lull. The tigers, who had believed the door to be locked, found now that it was merely shut, and they pushed it open. Inside, the mosque was profoundly dark. An oil lamp had been lit to guide the prayers, but it had been extinguished in the confusion. Two tigers came in to sift through the bodies with harrowing thoroughness. The first tiger, carrying a small flashlight, would point to people who still seemed to be alive. The second would finish the job. Ismail, already wounded in his thigh, was certain that he would die, but the two corpses lying on top of him kept him hidden from view. I thought of the people at home. What would they do? How would they cope with all this death? The tigers heard a sound outside and left the mosque. There was another suffocating silence. Then they came back in the mosque and shouted, "Everybody who isn't injured, get up. Come out and help us take the injured to the hospital." At this, Ismail's cousin, the 6-year-old Akram, jumped up and in tears shouted, "I want to go home. I don't want to be here." The tigers put the barrel of a gun into Akram's mouth and fired. "He was right by my feet," Ismail said, "and I couldn't do a thing to save him." Ismail's eyes had glazed over, and he wasn't looking at me any longer or looking at anything in the mosque. I found I couldn't look at him either. And so I stared down hard at my notebook, not really reading the words, but tracing the cursive with my eyes anyway from loop to loop. It gave me something to do. There was one final round of shooting. The tigers stood outside, just inside the doorway of the mosque, framed against the awful night, and raked the floor with gunfire. Ismail caught one of these bullets in his stomach. When they left, he heard a grenade go off at the intersection of roads near the mosque, another signal, he thought indistinctly before passing out. The attack lasted a total of 10 minutes. Ismail found this out later, because a clock on the wall of the mosque, its face shattered, had stopped cold at 8:10 p.m. Ismail spent the next 2 weeks in the hospital, intermittently conscious. In that time, the tigers carried out a second massacre in Erawur, 4 miles north, ranging through that village's Muslim areas all night to kill more than 100 people. For the next 2 years, Ismail was in and out of hospital, undergoing surgeries, learning how to walk all over again. He was frustrated, he said, by the helplessness of his community. "We stayed away from the tigers largely, and we weren't involved in their movement at all. Even so, we received no guarantee of safety from the state." After the slaughter at the mosque, he forbade his Tamil friends from ever speaking admiringly of the tigers. "Do it elsewhere, but not in front of me," I told them. "If you do, you're indirectly responsible for what happened to me." He had photographs, he suddenly remembered. We were back in his house now, and he lurched heavily into the next room to retrieve an album. One of those cheap commercial holders of happy memories that are sold in every corner store in the world. On its cover, a small blonde boy in a straw hat and denim overalls, snuggled up to a small blonde girl wearing Mary Jane shoes and a pink bow in her hair. In the album's first few leaves, Ismail's brothers and cousins clown around and mug for the camera. One photo, taken 3 months before the massacre, shows the four small boys packed tightly onto a green couch, Akram on the extreme left, his moon face clad in a smile. Immediately, on the next page, he lies supine on the mosque floor, his face turned to the left so that the camera cannot see the exit wound. As per custom, a strip of white cloth runs around his face, holding his jaw closed, and his wrists are also tied together, the body thus trussed in preparation for his burial. The floor around him is covered in blood. It speckles his white shirt and the skin of his arms. What is visible of his face, however, seems at first to be entirely unhurt. The right eye is closed as if in calm slumber, and only on closer examination does it become clear that his left eye, his left cheek, that entire hemisphere of his face, has disintegrated. In the space of a single page of a photo album, Akram's momentary life has come to a tattered end.
Did you send the book to Ismail?
I did.
Did he tell you what he thought? He didn't reply.
He cannot read English extremely fluently. So I called him and I said, the book is in English and you should give me your address. And he gave me the address and I sent it to him. I haven't heard back from him since. He isn't on email and it's difficult to get in touch with him. He doesn't have a cell phone. So.
It's hard to read. How was it to spend so many years of your life hearing these stories again and again, to walk around trying to do them justice?
It was odd when I was actually in Sri Lanka. I moved to Sri Lanka in 2011 in August, and I spent about 10 months there doing these interviews and researching the book. And while I was there, I was sort of so fully immersed in it that I guess maybe I wasn't sort of absorbing it as fully as I could have. And then I came back to India and I started to look through my material and began writing the book. And it was only sort of in this act of putting the words down again on paper, I felt like that was when the processing was happening. And it was difficult. I mean, it was difficult because you doubted the enterprise of writing itself. Because you felt that sometimes a lot of this pain and a lot of this loss is so great that there's nothing that can do it justice. And you feel, you know, I mentioned this in the section I read out a little bit, that you feel as if you're a parasite kind of feeding on it and putting it back onto a page as a part of your career, as a part of your job. And this is an ethical dilemma that you come across in journalism all the time, but it's particularly severe when you're writing about tragedy at this scale. And that caused me sort of many uncomfortable hours and, you know, sleepless nights. And I had nightmares and everything that goes with it. But I would wake up in the morning and I would remember, of course, that all of this paled in comparison to what these people had experienced. And so it was useful to put it in perspective like that.
The story that Ismail tells you and the events in the mosque would certainly have been at the order of Prabhakaran. And one of the achievements of the book is that you don't do that thing that I was stupidly suggesting about goodies and baddies. You follow him. You know, the thing about a 30-year war is you can follow him from how one goes from being a child to a man capable of giving these orders.
Right.
And then right through to his death and the complicated kind of response to his death.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit? How was it to try and understand him?
Yeah, I mean, it's a significant section of the first part of this book deals with, you know, these meetings and interviews I did with one of the young men who helped to found the Tigers in the mid-1970s. And he was very eloquent in sort of expressing the kind of frustration that the Tamils were feeling at the time when they were sort of stymied politically. Their political parties were too small and too insignificant to press for the kind of change that they wanted. And so he described it to me in terms that made it seem as if the emergence of a violent guerrilla group was almost inevitable. It was born out of frustration and anger and just an inability to do anything else. And so you kind of, while you don't, you may not condone it, you definitely do understand the kind of circumstances that these movements spring from. And you, it is possible to trace Prabhakaran's sort of trajectory from a young, angry youth who started off attacking only the army and not civilians through his, you know, the process where he became engorged upon his own self, you know, his own worth, his own importance, started to function as this dictator of a banana republic that hadn't even existed at that point, eliminated his rivals, took complete control of the group, started to behave in the way that tin pot dictators behave, you know, moving every week through the jungle in out of concern for his own life, but at the same time insisting that every bunker he had be equipped with a television and video cassettes and a swimming pool. There's this, you know, this anecdote that I found so... I tell this in the book. I was talking to somebody who was with the Tigers in the final weeks of the war. This is when the Tigers were, as I said, pushed away into a corner of the island. Their numbers had dwindled. They had no route of escape, and they had the might of the Sri Lankan army facing them. And so Prabhakaran's solution at this point was to hand out DVDs of the movie 300 and ask people to watch them, because he likened his situation to what was happening in Thermopylae. And this is the kind of semi-ludicrous sort of figure that he became. And he would be fully ludicrous if it were not for the fact that he was so powerful and violent. And this young man, again, the man who I talked about, who helped to co-found the Tigers in the 70s, grew disillusioned with Prabhakaran in the 80s and left, and now lives in London. He had, I mean, the kind of reaction that perfectly encapsulated this for me. I mean, on the day that the war ended, he told me, his wife told me, in fact, he didn't tell me this, his wife told me, he decided that he would get utterly drunk. And he spent the evening crying. And he was crying not for the death of Prabhakaran, who was a man he despised, but he was crying for the death, for the, you know, inglorious death of a movement that he supported when it started. And that was the tragedy of the Tamil cause through those 30 years.
Mm. Could you talk a bit, if you're happy to, about your friend Sanjaya?
Yeah.
For us.
I would be very happy to. The book is actually dedicated to Sanjaya. Sanjaya was a journalist in Colombo, a Sinhalese journalist, and he had come to study journalism in India, and so I met him many years ago, even before this book was sort of a twinkle in my eye, many years ago through common friends who were also journalists in India. And then he went back to Sri Lanka, and he started working as a freelance video journalist. He was the son of a prominent human rights activist in Colombo, and so he was actively involved in criticizing the state for what it was doing and for exposing a lot of what happened in the name of keeping the country safe. And so when I went to Colombo, Sanjaya was quite naturally my first point of contact. I lived in his house for a while. He set me up with people he knew. And we would sort of, and he was my Virgil through this entire you know, this entire stint through purgatory, in a sense. He would explain everything I went out and saw, I would come back and tell him about, and he would explain it to me, and he would build on it for me. We would go out and drink too much, and he would tell me stories from his own trips and his own journalism. He would explain context, and he was an immense raconteur. He was huge. He was vast. He had a belly that shook. And he would tell these stories, and he'd told them obviously many times before, but he would collapse in laughter even as he was telling them, and it was infectious. And this book wouldn't have been written without him. And then I came back, and the year this book came out, which is 2014, in January of that year, he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and he died before the book came out. It was tragic enough. It was doubly tragic because his mother died 2 months before him of breast cancer, and it was just a double whammy to hit that family. But he symbolized everything I came to love about Sri Lanka. A fierce intellect that is masked by a seeming sort of laziness, you know, an uncaring tempo. You know, everything moves very slowly in Sri Lanka in a way that is very easy to sink into. And it was just a joy to hang out with him and to live there. I mean, for all the horrific stories that I heard and the things that I saw, it's a beautiful country. And it's just, I mean, it's a cliche that it was sort of, you know, trouble in paradise, but it really is just a country that is worth visiting many times over.
That brings me nicely to what I wanted to ask, is you, when you talk about the motivation for writing this book, you talk about wanting to find what it does to the soul of a country to be in war for 3 years and to go through this. And I thought, if it's possible, and it might not be possible, to get you to elaborate on what you think the soul of Sri Lanka is. Because...
Well, I mean, I can explain it best by contrasting it with India, which is where I'm from and which is where I live. In India, you go to India and the warts are all out there for you to see. Every single problem that India has is raised time and time again in multiple ways. You see it all around you. It is difficult to escape the problems that India faces. Even the deep ones, sort of, there's like a wellspring that bubbles to the surface all the time. With Sri Lanka, I felt it was different. It was the exact opposite. It was as if you could go there and the veneer, the skin of the country was smooth and calm and unruffled, and people were friendly and warm. But there was this sort of this infection that was below the surface, and that it needed a little probing, but then once you did that, you could see sort of how deeply the rot had set in various sections of society. And this became apparent in the years after the fighting ended, because if you thought that would be the end of sort of frictions and animosities between communities, you were mistaken. The end of the war also saw the rise of an extremely powerful nationalistic Buddhist right wing, which was surprising and disturbing. The infection spread to sort of pitting the Buddhist right wing against the Muslims, the minorities who had only 20 years earlier been ostracized by the Tamils, by the Tigers, and were now being sort of targeted by the Buddhist right wing. And so you could see that there was, you know, nothing had really been treated. And the metaphor of an infection really is good here, because it sort of spreads and it infects another part of the body, and it's difficult to track if you just look at the surface.
So how are things for the civilian Tamils there now?
Better than in 2013 when your ministers visited. What happened last year was that there were two elections, and the government and the family that tightly controlled the government and that was responsible for a lot of the human rights abuses and wartime atrocities towards the end of the war, that government was voted out. There's a new president who came into power last January, and then there's a new parliament that came into power in the summer. And both of these institutions were sort of elected on the promise that they would begin investigations into war crimes and human rights abuses. They would begin a process of redrafting the constitution to make sure that civil liberties were accorded more equitably. There would be a fresh commission. There was a commission earlier to record testimony of people who were caught in the war zone. That was a miserable failure because it was weak. It had no will and no spine. There was a promise that a new commission would be set up. So all these things are in play. As I said, I mean, things move slowly in Sri Lanka, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, because these things really take time to sink in and do properly. And definitely, you know, I visited there last June, and then I was there again in January, and you feel a certain relaxation of the mood in a way that wasn't there in 2011 and 2012. Having said that, there are still families out there who don't know what happened to their loved ones who were abducted by the security forces during the end of the war and then after the war. You know, human rights activists, journalists, all these people who disappeared and were never seen again, their status still remains unknown. There is still a large problem of sort of land that was taken over by the army in the north and the east that hasn't been given back to the people who used to own it. There are still people who feel displaced, even though they've been sort of shunted off to villages that are not their own, and told to stay there and to begin life anew. These are people who still, not surprisingly, feel displaced, and their methods of their modes of employment have been taken away from them. So, these are problems that I think will take years to resolve. And what is key to watch now is whether the political will to resolve them persists beyond the election year, which was last year.
Mm. When you go back, are you going back as a journalist, or are you going back as just a tourist who loves Sri Lanka?
No, now I'm just going back as a tourist. I suppose in one sense I always have my journalist hat on. It's a hat that you kind of sew to your head when you start working and you never take it off. But both these trips have been sort of holidays to see friends. You know, I was not able, for example, to see Sanjay in the last few months before he died because I was in India and it was not advisable for me to return to Sri Lanka. I had by then written a couple of op-eds criticizing the government, and I was advised, including by Sanjay himself, not to return until the book was out and done.
Did Sanjay like those op-eds? Was he a fan of your journalism?
I consulted him on everything I wrote about Sri Lanka. I mean, he was, as I said, he was my fount of information. So, yeah.
There's a chance for you to ask some questions. I'd ask that you wait for a microphone to get to you so that everyone can hear it. And it is being recorded for the Australian Federal Police. So speak very clearly when you ask your questions. They're everywhere. There's one here in the front row.
State your name. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, Rodney Swan, if you want to know the name. Yeah. Thank you. It was a very interesting presentation. I was moved by your reading. I just want to ask you to talk to us a little bit more about the situation today. So the question is in two parts. Did the Tamil civilian population support the Tigers? And when the Tigers went off, the Tamil civilians obviously remained. To what extent was there still harassment by the Sinhalese government towards these Tamils? Now, I ask that second question because in my mind I'm trying to put some context into the Sri Lankan and Tamil asylum seekers that I understand that one boat was turned away just a few weeks ago, and they must know of the horrors of Manus Island, and yet they can go to India for safe haven, but they still come all the way here. So I'm wondering whether there is still some sort of conflict there.
The answer to your first question is a slightly complex one. As I mentioned, in the late 70s and early 80s, the Tamils didn't really have much of an alternative, politically speaking. And so I think at that time, the tendency to support the Tigers and other guerrilla groups was strong because they really felt as if they were out of options. That waxed and waned through the course of the 80s and then the early 90s, mid-90s even. There was definitely sort of, there were many cohorts of young men and women who actively and eagerly joined the Tigers, believing that this was a cause worth fighting for. I think the Tigers began at some point to lose traction among a majority of the population. And this happened partly because they were brutal with the Tamils who were living under them. As I mentioned, in the mid-2000s, they started abducting teenagers to fight in a losing cause. And that was certainly, I mean, I think by that point, the majority of the Tamil population had soured on the Tigers. This was a fluid situation. To your second question, which is what happens once the war is over in terms of harassment by the state, it was still, between 2009 and 2014 and 15, that harassment was still strong. I mean, it obviously took different forms in different places and at different times. But for example, the north of Sri Lanka, which was the spiritual home of the Tigers, this is where Prabhakaran came from. This was always where the state feared another guerrilla group would emerge, was heavily militarized to the extent that at one point when I was in Jaffna in the north, there was one soldier for every four civilians in that region, which was higher than at any point in Sri Lanka's history in any area of Sri Lanka. The security forces, the army, expanded after the end of the war, counterintuitively. There was more money given for recruitment, more money given for equipment. And so it was, for a lot of this time, it was a police state. There were big camps that were set up, internment camps that were set up in the wake of the war where people were held. Unspeakable things were done to them, and a lot of that, I think, still has to come out, partly because, some of the murders and the abuse Obviously, the murdered don't talk, and the people who are abused are still in fear of telling their stories. And I think we will learn even more about that in the years to come. In the context of the boat people and people who are still coming to Sri Lanka, I mean, it's, you know, I talked a little bit about the fact that there are still many people who have had their livelihoods not restored to them, their land and their property not restored to them. These are lives that have essentially been broken. And while they're not necessarily harassed today in the way that they were even 2 years ago, there is still they have not been restored to the lives that they led earlier. And it's difficult. I think it's the sort of thing that you have to weigh on a case by case basis to even say how safe somebody is back home and how dangerous their situation is. And I felt to go out on a limb here and talk Australian politics for a little while, but to turn away a boatload of people before hearing their testimonies, I think, was sort of premature.
And by all accounts, the boats they sent back, the people they returned were immediately arrested and taken into custody by the security services.
Yes, because, I mean, Sri Lanka is very conscious about its international image, and to sort of flee Sri Lanka as a refugee and to then be returned to it means that you've sort of been putting this image in jeopardy. Mm. And I'm not surprised that they were. Also, I mean, the Sri Lankan government mistakenly thinks that anybody who wants to flee Sri Lanka now is still sort of either betraying the country or was a former guerrilla or, you know, harbored sort of malice towards the state. And so to flee is to be a suspect, rather contradictory, but.
There are other questions, and I'm sorry to do this, but I've got a microphone, so I'm going to be selfish. That question just made me think of the retired major.
Living in Canada.
Yeah. Firstly, he tells a wonderful story, but just as a Tamil fighting for the Sinhalese army, it seemed to me to illustrate the way in which the division in the island is in individuals as well as in the society itself.
And I was enormously interested in this, so sort of the ways in which people are conflicted within themselves as they go through a larger conflict. And so this person who I talked to at great length and sort of profiled in my book was a young Tamil major in the Sri Lankan army who signed up for the army at the time, you know, at a time before the war started, and thought it was his natural duty to go into the army because his father had been in the army and this was something he wanted to do. And he felt a strong loyalty towards the Sri Lankan state. And then after the war started, he became increasingly conflicted about his loyalties. He became conflicted about the way in which the Sri Lankan state was treating Tamils. And at some point in the early 90s, he leaves. He leaves Sri Lanka to go to Canada, where he still lives. And that sort of the story of his life through the 1980s was fascinating because, I mean, it tells a story of somebody who's thinking through these issues himself as they're sort of transpiring around him.
He has a great line about being a bat, kind of rejected by the mammals and rejected by the birds.
Yes.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Another question. Let's take one from a woman first before we go to another man. There's one here in the second row. Sorry.
You spoke about what a slow process it might be for the Tamils to become perhaps safe and for the country to be at peace. Do you think it will always be a divided country?
I've been asked, in fact, by Sri Lankans about my title because I wrote this book after the war ended, and so their contention was that the island isn't really divided anymore. It's now unified. The state controls every corner of it. And I had to explain that the divisions I was talking about were more psychological, psychic in one sense. And I think those divisions, the kind of divisions where people are not sure of whom to trust and are not sure of how much they can trust the state, those divisions take a couple of generations at least to heal, if not longer. There are still young people in Sri Lanka today who have lived through the end of the war. These are people who will grow up with memories of that terrible carnage and of what was inflicted on them by the state. And so, you know, I cannot imagine that we will see the so-called end of these divisions for a couple of generations still. But But it's certainly possible to heal them, I feel. And I think that has happened before in other areas of the world, slowly and painfully and perhaps imperfectly, but it does happen.
Okay, we'll take a question on the aisle here.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate this very much because I myself am a Sri Lankan Tamil, having lived a good part of my life in Sri Lanka. And I share your sentiments about the actions taken against the minorities, especially the Tamils. But there's one point that is very controversial and is still in dispute after 7 years after the end of the war. And that is the manner in which the war was conducted,
yes,
especially by the government forces, and the numbers of people who were killed, either deliberately or otherwise. And there are conflicting accounts of this. One is Australian UN worker who lived there almost to the end of the war, and that is Gordon Wise, who's written the book The Cage. And there are other sources like Murali Reddy, an Indian journalist who was probably one of the last people to remain in the war zone till the very end of the war. Now, their dispute, the figures quoted are 40,000. I think Francis Harrison has quoted something like 140,000. We can go on and give astronomical figures, but I'm interested in a balanced view of how this war unfolded until the very end.
Yeah.
And I'd like to have your response to that.
Well, it's difficult to, I mean, numerically speaking, it's difficult to say. You know, in 1971, Bangladesh became independent after a brutal war, and there are still disputes about how many people died in that conflict, and it's been more than 40 years. So it's difficult, you know, we're still really in the early stages of reckoning with the war. What I can definitely say is that the Sri Lankan government's ridiculous figure of sort of 3,000 or whatever it is, a few thousand people killed, is most definitely wrong. And so whether it is the UN's 40,000 or whether it is, you know, other agencies' 80,000 or Francis Harrison's 140,000, that is something that we still need to come to terms with. We don't know. There hasn't been a proper sort of census and account taking being done of this yet. And a part of the reason is the way in which the Sri Lankan state, following the end of the war, then managed to sort of cordon off those areas where the shelling happened. You couldn't go there for years after the war. And presumably sort of hid or removed the evidence of how many people had died over there. So I think this will be a very challenging exercise to undertake. But the book is full of, and in fact the last section of the book is almost entirely concerned with how the forces conducted their final assault on the Tigers. And there is no question that it was brutal. There is no, as I said, I mean, Gordon Wise is completely right when he talks about how, I mean, in wartime there's this tradition where once the Red Cross sets up a hospital in a war zone, the Red Cross transmits the coordinates of those hospitals to both sides fighting the conflict. And on two occasions, the Red Cross gave these coordinates to the Sri Lankan army only for those very locations to be shelled a few hours later. And I think the evidence is too difficult to ignore, and Gordon talks about this at extensive length in his book. It is difficult to ignore the fact that the Sri Lankan army was purposely shelling civilians, and the people they captured were sort of indiscriminately either killed or tortured. So, I mean, there's no doubt about that in my mind.
We'll take a question in the front row, and then we will come to you, sir. I have to say, not as a judgment, but this side of the room, much quieter than that side.
My question is of something which happened much more recently. That's the last election.
Yes.
There were some reports about Premadasa's loss having been engineered by the Indian government.
Rajapaksa.
So what is your opinion on that?
The Indian government has a great track record of just meddling in the Sri Lankan war in ways that just did nobody any good. In the late 1980s, there was an Indian peacekeeping force in Sri Lanka, ostensibly sent there to repair relations between the government and the Tigers. In the process, alienating both, to the extent that there was one ludicrous phase where the Sri Lankan government was arming the tigers to fight the peacekeepers. India, ladies and gentlemen. It's definitely true that, I mean, you know, there wasn't an Indian intelligence agent who was infamously kicked out of Sri Lanka during the elections because he was found to be assisting opposition leaders in their campaign efforts and providing intelligence to the opposition. It's difficult to say how comprehensively India influenced the result of the election itself. Because these things are abstract. I mean, even if you could sort of put together a narrative of what these agents did and what Indian intelligence did, you know, you don't know what happens when somebody goes into a polling booth to vote. So, in short, I'm afraid actually I don't have an answer for you. But those conspiracy theories definitely do the rounds in Delhi. And as I said, there is definitely one instance where an Indian intelligence agent was sent back forcibly out of Colombo. And, you know, I have heard that he was certainly working to empower the opposition during. But as I said, India does this a lot with its neighbors.
Question up here.
Not knowing much about Sri Lanka, I had kind of assumed that it was, you know, tribalism, Sinhalese majority versus Tamil minority. But then you brought up religion. And as you were talking, I was thinking, well, maybe there are other factors like poverty or class or urbanisation. So I'm just wondering whether you have thoughts on some of the broad structural things that might have contributed beyond that the discussion that you started with about the loss of rights.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, when I went to Sri Lanka, I went there with the classic arrogance of somebody from a big, complex country going to a small country nearby. I'm not saying anything about Australia and New Zealand. I'm just saying. And I was proven to be extremely wrong because you're right. I mean, it becomes extremely complex once you go there and start sifting through what the war entailed. I mean, one example that I always like to give is when I used to go to the library in Sri Lanka, to the archives, and to look at old census reports. And I would go through the census reports, and I was struck by one thing is that especially after Sri Lanka became independent, they used to conduct a census by ethnicity. And you would look at the categories of ethnicity, under ethnicity, and, you know, the first category would be Sinhalese and the second would be Tamil. And you'd think, hang on, that's not an ethnic category, that's a linguistic category. That's odd, because if you look at Sinhalese and Tamils, much as Sri Lankans claim to be able to tell them apart, I mean, it's not always easy. And then you come to the third category, which is Muslim, and you say, hang on, that's a religion. That's not, and the Muslims speak Tamil, so why are they distinct? And there's an interplay of all these factors that you have to sort of slowly disentangle. And then on top of that, there are, as you say, structural factors. Colonialism has a huge role to play here. I mean, the short explanation of why the Sinhalese resented the Tamils is because the Tamil minority held a disproportionately large number of posts in government, in the civil service. They occupied a disproportionately large number of university seats. And so you started to wonder why that happened, and you go back to the colonial era, and you realize that in the north and the east, which is where the Tamils live, the Americans had come there and set up mission schools whose education was conducted almost entirely in English. Whereas in the south, the British had largely left education to the Buddhist monasteries that had been functioning there forever, and the education there was conducted in Sinhalese. Now, if you then came to the modern era when Sri Lankans started to write exams to get into the civil service and the universities, the knowledge of English was a huge asset. And so the Tamils started to gain this massive foothold in these two institutions. And so colonialism has a huge part to play. I mean, you can look at history even further back, religious and ethnic and communal frictions that date back to almost, you know, the 0 CE in one sense, 2,000 years. And a lot of this is sort of laid out in my book, and it's fascinating to page through. And you come to realize that it's not, as you said rightly, it's not just a Sinhalese versus Tamil problem at all. Religion and history and caste, which again I haven't talked about here, but that plays into it. There's a lot that goes into it, yeah.
We've got time for one last question, and I'm sorry, this woman over here had her hand up. The microphone, just over the far side, sorry. Talk amongst yourselves. No, don't. It'll be disruptive.
Hello, my name's Gwen, and this is probably a trivial statement or question, but I was in Sri Lanka during the elections last year, and I was very fortunate to have a Sinhalese gentleman who was Catholic showing me around the place, and he was very forthcoming in talking about the election. And the thing that I felt that there was a great euphoria after the election, because so many people in Sri Lanka actually voted for... this is the information that I was being given. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it was the largest turnout of voting people. And there seemed to be such optimism because of the takeover... Oh, well, not the takeover, but the displacement of the corruption of the previous government. And there just seemed to be such a feeling of hope everywhere that you went. I'm just wondering, you've been there since the election. Do you think that there's room, that this is actually still going to happen, that there will be a more even playing field, that things will actually be achieved that they promised?
Yeah, it's certainly something to watch out for, and certainly much more probable now than it was 2 years ago. I mean, I, for one, am sort of following with extreme interest this process that has started to take place of drafting a new constitution. And that's vital. Sri Lanka has had multiple constitutions through its history, and it was a constitutional problem in one sense that led to a lot of the aggrievements that the Tamils had towards the state. And so how that constitution will be drafted and what it will contain is a matter of enormous interest. And this commission, again, that is sort of, again, going to be empowered to go around the country, hearing testimony from people who were affected during the war, and what it does with that testimony. So in one sense, what has happened now is that the stage has been set, but some action still needs to happen on that stage. And it's very difficult to predict whether that will or will not happen.
I'm afraid we're completely out of time. I had one more question myself, but given your question was about optimism, I think it would be churlish for me to go back to any other territory.
Sure.
Optimism's a good note to end on. And we do have to move, but I cannot say strongly enough, this divided island is a work of extraordinary journalism. I don't think you'll be surprised to hear that, having heard its author today. As well as being searing and unflinching in its gaze, it's also charming and funny and deeply humane. I can't recommend it highly enough, and I'd ask you to join me in thanking Sumant Sadranan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Sydney Writers Festival. You can find a range of other talks, interviews and discussions on our iTunes channel. And for more information about the festival, subscribe to our email newsletter through our website.